Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. It's been a weird week, hasn't it? Still feels a bit like a kind of post-Christmas New Year hangover where you're not quite sure what day it is. I think Monday Night Football has an impact on that as well. I noticed that our FA Cup fourth round tie with Bournemouth has also been chosen for a Monday night broadcast by BT Sport. So, you know, fuck you, BT Sport. Fuck you right in your fucking fuck place. I'm tired of Monday night football. I hate Monday night kickoffs. And we seem, maybe it's just me, but we seem to have had far more of those than is normal. Certainly more than is acceptable. To me, anyway, and that should be the baseline for this thing. Somebody did make a point to me very recently when I said, Monday night football broadcasters being monsters and all that kind of stuff, that, you know, we do benefit as a football club from the broadcasters giving us lots of money, which we can then spend on players like Nicolas Pepe and all that kind of stuff, which, you know, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. But at the same time, fuck them. Now, I know Bournemouth away isn't necessarily the longest trip that our away fans could have on a Monday night, but it's still a reasonable journey to get down, get back, got to get to work the next morning and all the rest. And it's, you know, maybe fine for us who are going to be sitting at home watching it on TV. But while that's happening, we'll have had a weekend of pundits and TV talkers and radio mouths and all these people talking about how the magic of the cup, it's not the same as it used to be. The FA Cup used to be such a wondrous thing, and now look, somehow the magic of this competition has been diminished. I mean, I wonder, could it be anything to do with playing the games on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, just so you fuckers can put it on the TV? I know, we all want to see the games. We're the thirst that they're quenching. Is this our fault? I'm not sure it is. It's not our fault. We all want to see our football team. That's the nature of football fans. That's something that can always be exploited. But those that run the game and manage the competitions, do they not have some responsibility for maintaining the magic of the cup? Like the magic of sitting down with your little fella. Maybe it's the first time he's watched a game on TV, sat down to watch his team with his dad. Come on there, son, me and you will sit down in front of the TV and we'll watch the match. And we'll forge a bond that will live for as long as we're together on this earth, because that's what happens. Fathers, sons, football club support, it runs through our very veins. Let me get the remote control out there. Well, it doesn't appear to be on the TV. How do I watch this game? Oh, that's right. I've got to go to a website of a betting company and place a bet or deposit some money in an account so I can live stream an FA Cup game via my favorite betting company. This, son, is what football is all about. Don't you ever forget this. This is a special day in your life. The magic of the cup, you fucking fuckers. Anyway, I appear to have gone off on a little bit of a tangent there. We've got a very busy show for you today because we are playing Crystal Palace tomorrow, and we will be getting a Crystal Palace view of their season, of the game, and Wilfred Zaha, of course, who was very close, well, not close to joining Arsenal. He was a player that Arsenal were interested in during the summer, and he very much wanted to join Arsenal. So we're going to talk to Dan from HLTCO about that a little bit later on. We'll also be finding out why signing another Cesc Fabregas. Imagine if we could find another Cesc Fabregas knocking around Barcelona or anywhere else for that matter, why that is no longer going to be a possibility for Arsenal or any other English club. That's coming a bit later on as well. But first, to kick us off today, Mikel Arteta has impressed most of us, I think, with the impact that he has had as the Arsenal manager. In a few short games, he appears to have done things which have made a group of players who, if they had all the medical textbooks in the world, still could not tell the difference between their arses and their elbows, and fashion them into something that looks like a football team. How has he done it? What are the things that he has done, and what might he do from a tactical point of view? Who better to talk about that than Michael Cox, who many of you will know as Zonal Marking. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Andrew.
Can I ask you what might seem like a very basic question, but is something like a team's structure and its organization, would that be considered a tactical element to what a coach is doing? Because, you know, it sounds like one of the basics, but in order to implement the kind of football that he wants to play, can you look at the way that he basically positions his team on the pitch as a tactical element to what Arteta is doing?
Yeah, definitely. I always consider tactics quite a broad thing. I think in punditry and journalism, it's often considered, you know, what a manager specifically does on the day to you know, expose weaknesses of the opposition or defend against them. But yeah, for me, it's quite a basic thing. It's about your understanding of phases of play and where you're positioned, and certainly the structure of the team. And I think it's particularly relevant for Arsenal when, you know, for 18 months, a key criticism of Emery's reign was really he didn't have a default style. He didn't have a default system. So just to see, you know, the players aligned in a pretty similar way in four consecutive games, I think is a significant step forward. And yes, certainly for me, a tactical improvement.
Can you sort of in the wake of Emery's departure posit a theory as to why it is that, you know, somebody who was considered or widely considered a tactician in the sense that, you know, he looked at what the opposition were doing and he tailored his team around that, never quite put in place any foundations, any structures to his team. I mean, can you be considered a good tactician if your tactics are changing from one week to the next?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And to be honest, I think it's pretty perplexing, really, how badly Emery did. I mean, we knew that it was never convincing from the first half of the first season. He kind of stumbled along, picking up victories, obviously went flat towards the end of last year. And then the first half of this season, it really was quite disastrous. But I think actually the four games that Arteta's been in charge, particularly that one against Manchester United, really have put into context quite how, you know, lacking in a plan Emery was. And I guess the only real explanation is, or the only partial explanation is that he's so intent on, you know, adapting things from week to week to guard against the opposition's strengths that really there was no plan A, which I know is not an original argument, but I do think it is largely true. But I mean, it, you know, looking back with a few weeks, it's really baffling how badly Emery did. I mean, when there was the initial choice, I must say I was very much pro Arteta. I was excited by the concept of someone with new ideas coming in. But I actually thought Emery was the safe choice, if you like. I didn't think that there would be this kind of implosion and Arsenal would find themselves mid-table. So, yeah, it's I can barely begin to explain how badly it went towards the end. And, you know, with respect to Arteta, who I do think is a talented a very talented coach, and I'm very excited to see him at Arsenal. It hasn't taken too much for, you know, a staggering level of improvement, really.
I mean, I was going to ask you, is the fact that it was so bad under Emery making it a little bit easier for Arteta, in the sense that he's talked about, you know, a clean slate and giving every player a chance and what have you. But he's kind of come into a squad and a club which is, it needs to go in a different direction. So he can just basically abandon whatever was there and put in place his own ideas. He's not trying to shift them from one ideology to another. There was no sort of overriding ideology or philosophy to Emery's football. So, you know, people are saying it's the players. You know, they're uncoachable. You can't do anything with these players. Arteta has shown that you actually can. And, you know, we have to caveat that, as we do in the opening weeks of his reign as manager, by saying it is very early and, you know, a lot can happen. But in some ways, the fact that he himself can just wipe clean whatever was there and start fresh, I think is making it maybe a little bit easier for him and easier for the players to get on board with.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that there's always a danger of reading too much into the first few games. And we have seen a kind of new manager bounce at other clubs. But I really think that there's been two completely separate improvements. One is the tactical improvement, which, you know, we have seen quite clearly a new system, a real defined methodical type of build-up play and constantly getting players in good positions on the overlap in particular. But we also have seen the kind of, I guess, traditional element of a new manager bounce, which is a freshness and enthusiasm about the players. And, you know, management is a very difficult job these days. There's so many areas where you have to excel in. And I think Arteta already has shown that he has the attention of the players. He's clearly got the likes of Aubameyang and Ozil, whose future was uncertain a month ago, to buy into his methods. But yeah, there's also a structure and there's a clear plan. And it's, broadly speaking, I would say, you know, you can tell that he has been Guardiola's assistant for 3.5 years. And obviously the main question was whether he had what it takes in terms of, you know, in terms of personality to get the attention and the faith of the players. But I don't think that's been an issue. And certainly tactically as well, he seems very clued up and with very specific ideas for what he wants to do with this side.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote a very good piece in The Athletic about what he's done with the team. I'm sure many people subscribe, but for those who don't, I mean, could you describe what it is that he is doing, or what way he is setting his team up in fairly simple layman's terms, to sort of outline the tactical side of his work so far?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess one of the key parts of coaching at the top level these days is managers essentially want their sides to form a front five in possession, to cover both the flanks, to have someone in the center, and to have someone in the channels, or the half spaces, as they're generally called. And the interesting thing is how managers manage to do that from a starting system that obviously doesn't feature a front five. So I think Arteta's done it quite cleverly. He's played, obviously, Lacazette as the main striker, Nelson or Pepe as a permanent right winger. And then he's got Ozil as the number 10, who's drifting into an inside right position. Aubameyang, who's starting on the left flank, but has license to come into an inside left position. And that's because of the overlapping of either Saka or Kolasinac on the overlap, which in fairness was something we saw in terms of overlapping under Emery. But I think there's more of a structure now. And when you look behind that, it means that you've got another bit of, I'd say, clever play, where you've got Maitland-Niles usually is tucking inside from right back to almost become an extra central midfielder. Xhaka, I think, looks comfortable the way he's playing, drifting out to the left. So it's almost 2-3-5 in possession. And not only does that allow you to stretch the opposition and get players free in wide positions, it also means you've got a decent structure behind you, you know, with lots of players in the centre of the pitch in a position to guard against counterattacks. So I would say that's the main thing that we've seen from Arteta so far. There's been other improvements. I think particularly the pressing has been very good, not just with the energy of Lacazette and Aubameyang, which I think people have noticed, but also there's been an intelligence about the way that they've done that. They've been forcing the opposition into you know, pressing traps. And I think the Manchester United game was notable for how often United's defenders, Lindelof and Maguire, who are usually quite composed in possession, how often they just hoof the ball out, you know, either downfield or for a throw-in, was very obvious. And then finally, I think the main thing in terms of the possession is how often Torreira is getting on the ball and feeding it through to Ozil. And, you know, it sounds like a basic thing, but obviously Emery, for whatever reason, didn't fancy Torreira as a holding midfielder, and Ozil certainly not as a number 10 most of the time, sometimes not in the side, sometimes not in the squad. So just the basics of getting your two best playmakers combining, breaking the lines through the center of the pitch obviously opens up so many, you know, options for passing routes into attack. So it's just been so impressive in terms of the structure of the team and getting the good players in possession, which is a pretty major part of attacking football, I'd say.
Yeah, the possession thing is really interesting to me because, you know, throughout the Emery era, I never really felt like Arsenal were able to control games the way that they used to in, you know, I know things were a bit ropey towards the end of the Wenger era, but, you know, just simply having more of the ball, being unpressured at times. To me, it looks like Arteta is really focusing on possession, on keeping the ball, on what we can do with it. And we know, obviously, it can be a defensive tactic as much as it can be an attacking one, because the opposition can't hurt you when you've got the ball. But if you looked at the first half against Chelsea, the first half against Manchester United, Arsenal in possession looked in command of those games, and they haven't done that for quite a while. But also, even when they found it maybe physically more difficult in the second periods, the organization, the structure of the team allowed them to deal with the opposition in a more comfortable way than we have seen. So you think about the second half against Watford this season when Watford just ran Arsenal ragged, and there seemed to be no way of dealing with that. But even when United and Chelsea had more of the ball in the second halves of those games, Arsenal looked a hell of a lot more comfortable in and out of possession. I think that for me is a real step forward.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's been probably two areas where I wouldn't say they're concerning or say that, you know, as a criticism, because it's four games in and a little game little time on the training ground. But I think that the two areas I'd like to see an improvement are one, the kind of drop off in the second half, which is probably natural at this time of the year. And the second thing is, I actually don't think the scorelines have reflected Arsenal's dominance. I mean, the Chelsea game really should have been put to bed. Even the Manchester United game, I think Arsenal could have scored more. And I think actually that probably will just come from improvement from individuals. I think Aubameyang and Lacazette and Ozil have been getting the ball in good positions and not necessarily, you know, doing what they usually do. Maybe a part of that is the tiredness as well, not just at this time of the year, but because of the regime and the new pressing. But that should, you know, I think that it's easy to see both those areas improving in terms of fitness, you know, over the next couple of months when the schedule isn't quite so packed, and in terms of the finishing once the individuals just return to their top form. So, yeah, there's certainly elements to improve, and I think Arteta will probably appreciate getting, you know, a whole week on the training ground, albeit it's been a Monday night game, so not quite a full week. But, you know, ahead of Palace, he'll get more time than he's got so far to work on a specific game plan.
When you look at the Arsenal squad right now and you look at the work that Mikel Arteta has done at Manchester City, are there individual players there who you feel like he's going to be able to get a lot more out of?
Yeah, I mean, the obvious one is Torreira. I mean, obviously Guardiola's system at City really has always been based around midfield possession, and both Guardiola and Arteta himself really were playing in that deep-lying playmaker role that I think Barcelona have fetishized more than anyone else over the years. So Arteta knows all about how to play in that position. Obviously did so very well for Arsenal, particularly towards the end of his time when I think he dropped a bit deeper after Song left. So, yeah, I mean, just the way Torreira's been receiving the ball, I think, has been such a positive. He's been getting the ball right in front of the defenders. You know, he's comfortable on the turn, on the half turn, getting away from pressure. I think Arsenal will be much more adept than they have been in previous months. I think that Watford game is probably the best example of, you know, a game where they were trying to play out from the back and just look completely nervous about how to do so. So I think Torreira's improvement really has been the positive, because there were suspicions as well that if Emery didn't fancy him in that position or didn't fancy him at all, you know, maybe he didn't have such a big future at Arsenal. But now with Arteta in, you think he's probably the player that Arsenal can build around for the next few years. So I think that's a massive development for Arsenal.
How highly do you rate him as a footballer, you know, in that position? I know when he arrived, you know, I was very enthused in the sense that, you know, he brought a lot of qualities to midfield that I thought Arsenal had been missing. And it always seems strange to me that over the, you know, the Emery got maybe a little bit confused by him, or just didn't fancy him, or didn't like his size or whatever. But in terms of what he can bring to that role, because, you know, you think about Fernandinho at Manchester City, who is that guy in that club, you know, a physically much more imposing player. But as N'Golo Kante has shown, you don't necessarily have to be a huge man to be able to do that job well. So, I mean, is he somebody you think can really flourish in the Premier League?
Yeah, I think he's brilliant. You know, I'd almost want to ignore what I've seen of him in the 18 months so far, which is not a criticism of him. But like you say, Emery clearly just didn't take to him, certainly not in that position. But whenever I've seen him, you know, beforehand for his in Serie A or for Uruguay, I just think he's got really everything you'd want from a player in that position. Like you say, maybe lacking in physical stature, but I don't think it's too difficult to pair him with someone who brings that. I mean, I think in basic terms, Xhaka does have that. He's obviously a very frustrating player, but I think in theory it works quite well as a partnership. And yeah, I think there has been more of a shift towards players in his mould, you know, in terms of size and stature when you look at Kante, but also in terms of his forward-thinking ability on the ball. So yeah, I think he's the kind of player that you can build your side around. And if there's anyone who's going to appreciate a player like that, then it's Arteta.
Mm. A couple of quick final things. One is, you know, Arteta, as you say, played a deep-lying midfield role for Arsenal. But at Everton, you know, he was a much more advanced player, or played further up the pitch and was more creative. As he's trying to mold an Arsenal team into something more along the lines of the Arsenal that people expect to see, a team that can attack well, plays good possession football, fast attacking, skillful, all those kind of things. How much do you think that experience of his playing days, which are not too far in the past, will enable him to put in place those sort of philosophies and instruct the players as to exactly what it is he wants from them?
Yeah, I think it's a big bonus. I think the fact that, I mean, it's not often really you get a manager at a top level club who has played so recently, like you say. And it's a great bonus. I think it's a little bit like the fact that Arteta knows Arsenal. You know, I've been quite sick of hearing so much about certain managers who know certain clubs and why that's going to be invaluable. You know, it's not, you shouldn't appoint your manager for that reason, but if they are a very promising candidate overall, as Arteta was, then of course it's great that Arteta has knowledge of the club and of the youth system. And, you know, I think with a couple of players he said he remembers training them a little bit from when they were in the under-16s or whatever. So, yeah, I think Arteta really has a really great background in various ways to be the Arsenal manager. He knows the club, he knows the Premier League as a player. He's been assistant manager to probably the most innovative manager we've seen in Europe in the last 10 years or so. So, yeah, I think there's so much to be positive about. I think the one, you know, I realize it can sound overly positive after four games to speak about him like this, but the one thing personally I was a little bit afraid of was, one, he was coming to a side that really was a shambles a month ago, and two, there was such a packed fixture schedule with a couple of really difficult games as well against Chelsea and Manchester United, that I wonder whether he was going to be able to put his stamp on the side. But, you know, so far, without having time on the training ground, without having the opportunity to bring in his own players so far, I don't know whether that will happen. I just think it's, so many reasons to be positive for Arsenal, both on the pitch. And I think as a whole, you know, the Emery days, I think, will be remembered not necessarily for failures on the pitch, but just the kind of general malaise and in the stands, the Xhaka incident against Crystal Palace, where I don't think really anyone came off well from that, whether it was Xhaka or the fans or Emery. There was a kind of almost unraveling of the club, I think. And, you know, already things just seem a lot more united off the pitch as well.
Mm. Final question, and I'm asking you to look into your tactical crystal ball here a little bit, and I know it's just four games and he's got to work with what he's got to work with between now and the end of the season. Maybe there'll be an addition in January or two, who knows. I don't know that, you know, there's going to be significant business in January because of, you know, the nature of the market and everything else. But, you know, going forward, is there anything in particular that you sort of expect or maybe hope for Mikel Arteta to do from a tactical perspective? You know, are there new trends? Are there things developing in the game that, as a young, forward-thinking coach, he might put in place?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think maybe the most interesting thing Guardiola's done at City has been the use And to be honest, he did it more at Bayern Munich than he did at City. But the use of the fullbacks coming inside into central midfield to really prevent counterattacks through the middle, as I said about Maitland-Niles, I think that's maybe the interesting, most interesting trend of the last few years. But I wonder whether that really will play a part at Arsenal, because obviously Tierney and Bellerin are going to be the first choices when they're fit and are both very attack-minded. But I do wonder about Bellerin, because when we've seen him back after the injury, he hasn't quite looked himself in terms of his, you know, dynamic forward running, which I think is the main thing we appreciate about his game. But I've always liked Bellerin in possession. You know, I think he's a really intelligent player. He's good on the ball. And I think when he gets into the final third, he doesn't just whip crosses in, you know, into an area. He tries to pick out really kind of incisive balls. So what I'd be interested to see is, you know, whether when he comes back, whether he plays that role that Maitland-Niles has been playing, kind of coming inside into the centre of the pitch, because I do think he's got the intelligence and the technical qualities to play there. And I think it'd be really interesting to see a different side to his game, you know, not just overlapping constantly, because, you know, with Nelson and Pepe, we've got two players there who do stretch the play, albeit in different ways. Pepe comes inside more because he's left-footed. But to see the development of Bellerin, I think, could be really interesting because, I really like him as a player. And I think he's clearly a very kind of open-minded, intelligent, studious guy who might be up for kind of changing his role. So, yeah, when Bellerin is a big part of the side, I'd be interested to see what Arteta does with him.
All right. Well, something to look forward to. And before we let you go, just to let people know that you do have your own podcast now. Apparently everyone's got one, but you have one called Zonal Marking. You don't have to be a subscriber to The Athletic to get it, though. Maybe just give people like 2 seconds about what it's about. Obviously tactics, but, you know, on a theme, I guess.
Yeah, it's just one every week. We focus on a particular topic every week. So this one's won't get many listeners from this podcast because it's about Harry Kane's development. But we'll certainly be looking at Arteta in upcoming weeks. And we also did a really good one when Ljungberg first got appointed as caretaker manager, about his background and basically how he came to be in charge of Arsenal for a few weeks, you know, having not really been the kind of player you would suspect would be a manager. So that was a good one. But yeah, there's different subjects a week, some about individuals and some about kind of wider themes in football. So yeah, it's like you say, it's free to listen to, so check it out if you get the chance.
Yeah, in all the usual podcast places. We'll leave it there, Michael. Thank you very much indeed.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you very much indeed to Michael. You can find him on Twitter at @zonal_marking. You can read his stuff in The Athletic, but you don't have to be a subscriber to The Athletic to listen to the podcast, and you can subscribe to that in all the usual podcast places. Surprisingly enough, it's also called Zonal Marking.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Now, over the years, Arsenal have brought in countless young players from Europe. Some have been hits, some have been misses. One of those great hits, of course, was Cesc Fabregas, another that's in our squad and not quite in the team at the moment because of injuries, Hector Bellerin. Young players who arrived at Arsenal into our academy, snapped up from clubs across Europe. Maybe it's a little bit dodgy, but that's the way the rules work, and it's free. It's free for any football club to take advantage of those. I saw a tweet today from Christopher Flanagan, who said, "It's a shame to think that after this transfer window, Arsenal will never again be able to bring in a player like Fabregas or Bellerin at academy level." Christopher is with me now. He is the managing editor of the International Sports Law Journal. Christopher, why is this the case? It's the B word, right? Not Bentner.
No, it's nothing to do with Nicholas Bentner, to the best of my knowledge. obviously, he is very influential. Yep, it's to do with Brexit. That's right. And Brexit is going to affect, well, like with all industries, Brexit will affect the football industry, but has some kind of quite idiosyncratic and, I think, interesting impacts on football, particularly in respect of the transfer market, because the transfer market is, in essence, about the movement of people. And given that football is kind of inherently international, it's typically about the movement of people across borders. And obviously, I think everyone knows and realizes that Brexit is going to influence the ways in which people can do that. And there's going to be kind of two, I think, main points. So it's going to affect transfers generally, because there'll be a loss of the unfettered right of freedom of movement across the EU. But there's also going to be a specific impact in respect of the recruitment of high-caliber academy players like Bellerin and like Fabregas. And that is because of the particular way in which FIFA's rules work. So you get this kind of interesting intersection between FIFA's rules and EU law. And what FIFA's rules say, basically, is that you cannot transfer players until they are 18 years old. Now, that kind of sounds incompatible with what we know about the recruitment of Fabregas and Bellerin at Arsenal, for example. And that is because there are, within FIFA's rules, three exceptions to that outright ban. Now, those exceptions are players can move across borders under the age of 18. They can do an international transfer into a neighbouring association where that player lives no more than 50 kilometres from the border. Now, obviously, in the case of the Premier League, in the case of England, there are no kind of contiguous land borders with EU countries. Most of that is in the sea. Clubs don't tend to recruit many players from the middle of the ocean, so that's not very helpful.
So we're talking like Spain, Portugal, France, Germany.
Yeah, exactly. You know, those so if kind you've got someone who lives on the border in the Pyrenees, they could
the Alsace.
Go to either France or Spain. Not very helpful for the Premier League. No. Another one of the exceptions is where a player's parents move, and that has to be for legitimate reasons. I think you do hear reported cases of clubs contriving to give jobs to parents, but generally that's something that FIFA would take a very dim view on. And the final exception is in respect of 16 and 17-year-olds who move within the EU, or actually the EEA, the European Economic Area. So what that means is Premier League is in the UK. Currently, the UK is in the EU. So the Premier League clubs, including Arsenal, can take players, they can transfer players from other clubs, other countries inside the EU without having to worry about this outright ban. And obviously that's been particularly fruitful for Arsenal. You know, we've talked about Fabregas and Bellerin. There's Joao Lopez, I think, currently in the academy. And partly this has been a function of the way that the Spanish system works and the UK system works. Because in Spain, young players can't sign contracts until they're 18, whereas in the Premier League, they can do so at 17. So it means that clubs have been able to take advantage of that gap to give contracts to the likes of Cesc Fabregas, to attract them over. And what that has meant is obviously that the Premier League has been quite an attractive place to come for younger players. And given that at the end of January, the UK will leave the EU, that specific exemption will fall away. So the outright ban will apply unless one of those other two exceptions can be applied.
Which is unlikely.
Sorry, go ahead,
Andrew. No, I mean, that's sort of unlikely given the difficulty or the very specific nature of those two other exceptions.
Yeah, that's right. They can't be used generally to recruit players who you want to recruit because they are really high caliber players.
Yeah. So what about the people who would say this could be beneficial for young English, British talent at a club like Arsenal? It would provide more opportunities for them because, you know, we see a lot of young players come from abroad, come to clubs, not just Arsenal, but to all the Premier League clubs, and the vast majority of them don't make it. And they go back to Europe and they, you know, ply their trade somewhere else in Europe. And there's an argument, I'm not necessarily saying it's one that I agree with, but that, you know, for the English players or for the English national team, all those kind of things, this could actually be a good thing.
Yeah, so that is certainly possible. And if you look at a club like Arsenal, where there is now, and I guess for a while has been, a very productive academy producing English players, that could be something that runs to Arsenal's benefit. Because what this is likely to do is put an additional premium on English players, because it's going to be harder to recruit high caliber players from abroad. You know, you've got a smaller pool of players you can get at. So if you can produce really high caliber players, then that is a good way of kind of having an influence on the market. You could sell those players and make good money for them on the basis that clubs are going to find it harder to get players from elsewhere. And one of the other things I touched on at the start was the fact that generally it's going to be harder to recruit players because another thing that will be lost when we leave the EU after any transition period, and I won't bore people with the kind of semantic details of that, but after any transition period, the unfettered right of freedom of movement across the EU is going to fall away. So that means for every player that a club wants to recruit internationally, they're going to have to satisfy whatever immigration rules are put in place at the relevant time. Now, at the moment, I guess people will probably be aware that the rules function primarily based on how many international caps a player has and how good their national side is. So the better the team, the fewer caps you need to have.
There's also a transfer value rule that
recently. There's an appeal process where it can be taken into account various other factors, including transfer value, players' experience, some other factors, but that's a bit less certain. And I guess the other factor to consider is that's the rules that are in place at the moment. The FA might want to make this more restrictive in the future to encourage more domestic players. So that's still quite up in the air. We don't really know what that's going to look like in the future. But what it is almost certain to mean is that it will be harder to recruit players. If you consider Gabriel Martinelli, for example, one of the reasons Arsenal were able to recruit him and bring him into the first team quite easily is because he had dual citizenship, Brazilian and Italian, or he had an Italian passport, which meant that because he was able to live and work in the EU based on his Italian passport, he can exercise that right anywhere in the EU, including the UK. So we didn't have to go through a convoluted application and appeals process in the way that, say, Joel Campbell had to go through.
There is another sort of aspect to this as well. And one of the things that we've seen in recent years is a growth in young English players going abroad, going to Europe. And taking full advantage of the fact that there is this freedom of movement, this ability for them to go and live and work in any of the European member states. Jadon Sancho, for example, is a great example, moving from Manchester City to Borussia Dortmund and flourishing as a footballer to the point where he is, you know, one of the most highly coveted young English players around. He may not have got that chance if he'd stayed at Manchester City. Chances are he wouldn't have. We've seen Reece Nelson go to Hoffenheim. We've seen Emile Smith Rowe go to RB Leipzig. These aren't just football experiences, they're life experiences, they're cultural experiences, they're educational in terms of learning another language, all of those things. So there is a flip side as well, isn't there, for the UK becomes much more of an island, if you like, for the footballers, because they have their options restricted as well.
That's absolutely right. So UK-based players, when they are 16 and 17, are not going to be able to transfer into other EU countries in the way they can now, because the FIFA rules will prevent it. And additionally to that, it's going to be much harder for them to have any sort of transfer into another EU country, you know, kind of depending on what the respective country respective countries' immigration system ends up looking like, because they'll have to go through the typical immigration process. It's not a simple case anymore of, you know, you can exercise your right to live and work wherever you want in the EU.
What do you think is, I know it's hard to predict the future, and maybe the FA will come up with some rules, or maybe there might be some kind of, I've heard it suggested that football might be granted some kind of an exemption. I don't know why football as an industry would be any different from any other industry. And if football is given some sort of exemption, why aren't, you know, other businesses, other industries, which are far more reliant on people from the European Union, be given the same thing? I mean, at the end of the day, football's just an entertainment thing. But for the Premier League, which has marketed itself as the most popular league in the world, and it is clearly the most popular league in the world, but a big part of that is because it has been able to attract, for the most part, most of the best players in the world. You know, there are exceptions at other clubs and in other leagues that we can all see and we're all very much aware of. But, you know, the prestige, the power, the money of the Premier League makes it a very, very attractive place for players to come. And part of that is because it's really easy to do that. It's easy for clubs to make those deals happen because they don't have to go through all this kind of paperwork and rigmarole. So do you feel like it might potentially have a detrimental effect on, I hate to say it, but the Premier League as a product?
It's quite possible it will. And I think what it's quite likely we'll see, or quite possible we'll see, is a friction between the FA and the Premier League, where the FA want to focus on the development of English players who can play for the national team, and the Premier League wants to have the best possible players playing in their league, so it's the most marketable possible, the most marketable league possible across the world. And I guess there are other aspects of this as well. If you look at what's happened to the value of the pound over the last couple of years, it has plummeted, which has had an effect on the purchasing power of Premier League clubs. Simply, £1 does not go as far. So players might choose to go to other leagues where, in relative terms, they will be paid more, perhaps, than they would have before.
Just finally, are you... I know people are kind of probably, whichever side of the fence they might be on when it comes to Brexit, probably a bit sick and tired of hearing about it, because it's been so pervasive. It's just been part of the news cycle for so long now, and it's kind of one of those words that you'd prefer never to hear again. Certainly, you know, I get fed up with it. But are you surprised that more people aren't talking about the impact that Brexit might have on football? Because for all of us, this is kind of, our escape. This is something that we look forward to now again, because we've got Mikel Arteta, not that we did before, you know, but.
Well, actually, just to make a point on Mikel Arteta, he might not have ever come to either Scotland in the first place or England afterwards, based on the, as a player, based on the if he was Brazilian or American, based on the amount he had played for his national side, which was zero times.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I just mean that, like, it feels to me like it's a fairly, you know, if you're talking about it, how it's going to affect shipbuilding and the NHS and, you know, yeah, car manufacturing and, you know, groceries and simple things like, you know, essentials like medicine and the stuff that keeps people alive. I get that they're more important, but it feels to me like football in some ways has kind of got its head buried in the sand when it comes to this.
I mean, football is an important part of, you know, it might be trivial overall, but football is an important part of people's lives. It's something that people care deeply about. And to use a horrible cliche, I am surprised that the impact on football has not been a bigger part of the narrative around Brexit, because it's going to have a big impact, and it will mean that decisions are taken. Decisions about how the Premier League operates, what it looks like, are going to be taken out of the Premier League's hands and outside of clubs' hands. It will be more at the mercy of FIFA and generally in respect of the government at the time.
Mm. It is, you know, I'm always reminded of the Arsene Wenger quote, you know, where he talked about, I don't look at a player's passport, I look at his quality, which is, I think, the right way to look at it. And that's something, unfortunately, that Premier League clubs are not going to be able to do when all this goes down. But look, thank you very much indeed for your insight. And maybe we can catch up again when it all happens and see what the impact has been. For now, though, Christopher Flanagan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you very much indeed to Christopher. You can follow him if you like. He's at LegalManFlan, at LegalManFlan on Twitter. So if you fancy a bit of law-talking, sport, finance-type stuff, he's your guy. It is a difficult conversation to have. The Brexit thing is something which exercises people quite a lot, one way or the other. But the reality is that it's going to have a big impact on football. And of course, many other things, and there are more important things, but football is why we're here. So the impact of that on football is something that I think we need to talk about. And not many people are doing that, which is, it seems really, really strange to me, as if stuff is just going to carry on the way it's always carried on, or somehow just be magically okay. There are going to be things that we're going to have to deal with in the months and years to come, and we'll see what that does to football as we know it right now. Let's move on, though, and let's have a look ahead to this weekend's game against Crystal Palace at the weekend. They've had some decent results against us in the not-too-distant past. So to give us a bit of a flavour of their season and what's going on at Crystal Palace right now, I'm delighted to welcome Dan from HLTCO, which is Hopkin Looking to Curl One. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Not too bad, thanks. I have to start with the obvious question. Who is going to take your penalty this weekend now that Milivojevic is suspended?
It is a very good question, and one that I'm not 100% sure I can answer with any degree of certainty. It's also, given the fact that we've got a huge injury crisis on our hands, it's a difficult thing to even say who we're going to have out as a starting 11, but I would imagine, should we manage to get one, as we so often have in the past against you, I wouldn't back against Jordan Ayew taking it, purely because he seems to be leading the line and is probably our most obvious goal threat. And without Luca, it's all bets off, really.
Yeah, Ayew is your top scorer this season with 5 goals in the Premier League. It is a bit of a problem, is it, goal scoring?
In general, yeah. I mean, it's obviously something every club would like to have more of. And we have, in the past, obviously spent relatively decent sums of money to try and get strikers in, with Benteke and Alexander Sørloth, etc. But yeah, we do seem to struggle in front of goal. I think from a Palace point of view, it's difficult to know whether Roy Hodgson's tactics are the main driving force behind our lack of goals, or whether it's just a bit of a mental block, because we've got, you know, Zaha on one flank who often beats his man and gets a ball across, but then at the same time we often struggle to get men in the positions around the 6-yard box to tap them home. So, you know, we watch it from the stands week in, week out, and it is a source of frustration, but it's difficult to know what the answer is, really.
I mean, is it a creativity thing, or is there a lack of that? I mean, that's another thing that every team would love to have, is more creativity. But in Zaha, for example, you do have a really dangerous player, somebody who can drive at defences into the box, win penalties, as our Arsenal fans know so well. But is it about getting support to him? I mean, what is the feeling with Roy Hodgson and the job that he's doing at Palace? Is how is he regarded amongst the fan base?
I think I speak for most Palace fans when I say that, regardless of the grumbles many have over his tactical rigidity and his favouritism of certain players, you can't really moan at the league position we find ourselves in, given the transfer budgets he's been given since he arrived. But I think most teams in the league know, and it's probably not too much of a revelation given the golfing class between Zaha and the rest of the midfield, that our main tactic seems to be to sort of get the ball to him on the flank and just let him do his thing. There is a definite source of frustration in the sense that Roy Hodgson seems to be allergic to number 10s. We brought Max Meyer in from Germany a year or so ago. He gets very limited game time in the midfield. We brought in Victor Camarasa on loan from Real Betis over the summer. He was previously at Cardiff and he's a ball-playing midfielder. And yet again, he hasn't really seen it fit to give him many minutes. I believe he's going back to Spain in the next couple of days to try and find another club. So he seems to, Roy Hodgson in general, favour the defensive midfielders over the creative ones, which, you know, from a results perspective, he can point towards points on the board and say that's great. But when you're trying to get a team that's going to get you off your seat and sort of looking for the next goal to go in a 4-3 win, you're never going to get that with Roy Hodgson. So it's just one of those things, I think.
Yeah, being slightly allergic to number 10s is something that we were a little bit used to with Unai Emery. And it strikes me you would probably this weekend be happier facing an Unai Emery Arsenal than a Mikel Arteta Arsenal.
Without a doubt. He seems to have, from a neutral perspective or someone that's looking on from afar, he seems to have completely re-energised the Arsenal squad. I mean, I appreciate, you know, top-class footballers, they can blow hot and cold, but in the short period of time he's been there, it does look like a switch has flicked for you. So obviously, from a Palace point of view, there is a greater deal of trepidation going into the game than there would have been before he arrived.
What is the situation with the injuries? I mean, who is not available for you this weekend that ordinarily would be likely to play?
I believe at last count we had 11 first team injuries.
Wow.
We haven't got a left back at all, as far as I know, unless Jairo Riederwald, who was filling in there as a central midfielder in the first place, is back because Patrick Van Aanholt and Jeffrey Schlupp are out. Mamadou Sakho's injured, Joel Ward's injured, Milivojevic is suspended, Andros Townsend's injured. We've had Cheick Kouyaté filling in at centre-back instead of central midfield because of the lack of bodies. Max Meyer went down with an injury against Derby at the weekend. It's basically, Roy Hodgson said after the Derby game that in all of his years in management, which everyone knows is about 634, that he's never known an injury crisis like it, which puts extra focus on us to try and get some business done in the January window.
Yeah. Are you confident that the club are going to do that? Because it's a difficult thing for most clubs. I mean, they all want to, but you're sort of caught between this, if not a rock and a hard place. You kind of know that the summer is the best time to do business.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think from a Palace fan's point of view, and it's something Roy Hodgson said in the press last week, he's been asking the board for two new strikers and two new fullbacks, one on each side, for over a year now. As far as I know, we're being linked semi-seriously with loan deals for St. Tosin from Everton and Kyle Walker-Peters from Spurs. But I think most fans are just frustrated at the persistent loans that we try to get in without parting with too much cash. I think there's a bit of politics going on behind the scenes with part of our ownership and their reluctance to spend a huge deal of money. But, you know, it's, as you say, January's not an ideal time to do business at the best of times, but given the lack of bodies we've got at the moment, we haven't really got a choice.
Yeah, it feels like with that amount of injuries, you're going to have to dip into the market. Obviously, it hasn't happened ahead of this game. So what way do you think he is going to approach this, because I think Palace are unbeaten in the last three against Arsenal, and very memorably you beat us at the Emirates last season, a game which really had some profound consequences, I think, for the end of our season and for the reputation of Unai Emery, because it all went wrong towards the end of the season. And that Palace game, if you'll excuse me, that Palace game was really, it felt like that was the cliff we started to go off.
I remember at the time when we managed to get the win, the sort of ripple effect that it had on your fan base and on the club in general was quite major. And the thing with Roy is, like, as I say, I can moan about certain aspects of his management, but last season we went and beat you at your ground, we beat Manchester City. You know, we've proven that against the big sides, with the way he sets us up, because we're tactically sound and we know our jobs, that we can grind out results. I think if we had a fully fit squad, I wouldn't be necessarily unconfident of getting a point or three. But given the sheer number of injuries we've got, I think the initial tactic will just be 4-5-1, remain stoic and try and get to half time at least with parity, and then potentially go from there, because that seems to be, especially this season, a tactic that he is employing regularly.
Let's talk, if we can, about Wilfred Zaha, who was very, very strongly linked with Arsenal over the course of the summer. He is an Arsenal fan. His representative, who I think is his brother as well, is it? Made it pretty clear he wanted to leave Palace. He wanted to join Arsenal. And that didn't happen for, you know, many reasons. Most obvious is the fact that Arsenal never came near the valuation that Palace had on a player who just signed or relatively recently signed a new long-term contract. What is your feeling about the way this season has panned out for him? It looks from the outside, at least, like he is a player who... I can't say that, you know, he's sulking or whatever, but it's not uncommon for a player who really wants to move away and doesn't get that move to find it difficult to reach their best form.
It's tricky with Wilf, because from a pure aspect of the way his game works, it tends to blow hot and cold, because if he gets the better of his fullback, then, you know, he'll run right. And if he doesn't, then people assume he's overrated. In terms of Palace's or Palace fans and their general view of him, I think most people are aware that he's given enough to the football club over the last 10 years and has clearly shown his affinity with us publicly enough to say that if the right move and the right financial deal comes in, we wouldn't stand in his way. The problem I think Wilf's got is that he's made a bit of a rod for his own back, in the sense that he is far too valuable to us for us to accept a bid of anything less than £60 to £70 million. But to clubs such as Arsenal, whether it's Chelsea, Everton, doesn't matter who, the idea of spending that much money on Wilfried Zaha, who's never, you know, produced the sort of numbers that you would associate with a transfer fee of that size, is, you know, lacking in logic. So he's in a bit of a rock and a hard place himself, because he's made himself so indispensable to us as a team, given that everything goes through him. It may take some time to adapt stylistically, you know, in his general approach, because he's so used to getting the ball whenever we attack. At the same time, I don't think many Palace fans bear him any ill will, and should a deal come about in the January window or in the summer that sees us financially reimbursed to a satisfactory level, I don't think anyone would, you know, wish him any ill will at all. But it's a case of actually finding a club that are willing to spend that on him, and that's really where we've struggled.
It is a weird one, isn't it? Because, you know, I know when we were linked with him during the summer, you could look at the Arsenal team and think, yeah, this guy could do a job, this guy could bring something to the team that we don't have. But when you delve into the numbers, when you look at his age, when you look at, you know, is there sort of any resale value, if you like, based on what Palace were looking for him, and you can understand in the market why it was they were looking for that money, but the, you know, in terms of goals and assists, you know, he's never been quite prolific enough to convince you that, yeah, we should go the extra mile for that, which is probably why Arsenal spent a relatively similar sum on Nicolas Pepe, who's a few years younger and probably just has that potential to be a bit more. So it's one of those where I think people, Arsenal fans, would have probably been happy to have him, but more at the price we were offering, even if you can understand why Palace turned that down.
Yeah, I think given his age, I've said on social media over the last few months, because I get questions about him from all sorts of football fans daily, that he's sort of at a tipping point age-wise, really. Because 27, if he goes another year or two, then the prospect of any top six club spending big on him becomes far less of a you know, an option because of, like you say, resale value, potential, etc. You'd find, especially with wingers, that players like Pepe, even if they're not quite the finished article, they have room for growth. And he's sort of reaching that point of his career where, you know, that period of reaching another level is going to give way to, you know, being on a downward trend. And yeah. I think it's frustrating for him, but at the same time, we always hark back to the fact that he joined Manchester United, and at the point when we signed him back, he wasn't on a scrap heap as such, but people had already written him off. The fact that he's managed to get himself back to a point where clubs like Arsenal are looking to sign him is a testament to he and his potential and ability, but at the same time, the love and affection he's been shown at Palace. So it's a bit of a two-way street in my view.
Yeah, tough one, and it's probably why he was so keen to make the move this summer, you know, when you get to, what is he, 27 now? So
27, he was 27 in November, yeah. And he's also recently just changed his agent to a guy who is far more Machiavelli in his approach.
Right.
I mean, he was linking him last week with a move to Bayern Munich.
What was that story? How on earth is that supposed to happen?
I believe it's his agent trying to ruffle feathers because he's trying to, one, unsettle us, and two, give Wilf sort of ammunition to demand a move away. But like the same thing happens with the transfer valuation of 40 million. There's no way on earth, and it makes no logical sense, for Palace to greenlight a loan deal for our best player halfway through the season in the middle of an injury crisis anyway.
Yeah.
So I don't know what they were expecting us to say. And then what you always get is people saying 80 million's mad. Are they crazy? How do they expect anyone to pay that? And the answer Palace fans will always give is don't spend it then. We don't want you to pay it.
Yeah.
You know, it's there for a deterrent more than anything else.
Yeah. Well, look, we'll see what happens. I still have a little bit of fear about what he might do in the game on Saturday. So, look, he's done it before, and he is a very good player, and it's sort of one of those things where not quite a player coming back to haunt you, but a player who you've been linked with and it didn't happen, it would be one of those kind of football stories, you know, like a player going back to his old club. Okay, well, look, we leave it there, but just for any Palace fans that might be listening to this, you started as a sort of more traditional written website, but you've moved to podcasts, and you're on Patreon, and people can find your stuff on there. Just give us a quick rundown on what it is that you're doing.
So back in July, I sort of started looking into interviewing Palace personalities, and with sort of modest aims, really. It's managed to ratchet up to another level because I've managed to get interviews with the likes of Steve Parrish, who obviously owns a part of the football club. I've managed to interview Wilfried Zaha, Darren Ambrose, Dwight Gayle, a number of Palace personalities. And now, as of the start of November 2019, I do a daily podcast Monday to Friday, just breaking down the news that's taken place in the last 24 hours, up by 6 a.m. every morning. So hopefully that's going to lead to bigger things in the future.
All right. Well, listen, best of luck with that. Not so much best of luck on Saturday, but you know how it goes. Dan, thanks a million for your time. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
That's Dan, and he's on Twitter at HLTCO, at HLTCO. If you want to follow and improve your Crystal Palace knowledge, you can do that. But he also digs up some real rare football Twitter video gems, which are well worth a follow, in my opinion. So thank you again to him for his time, and we'll see what Arsenal can do against Crystal Palace tomorrow at Selhurst Park. The only bit of injury news that we have is that Hector Bellerin is not quite fit enough to play. He's recovering from his hamstring injury, and he's not going to make this one. Apart from that, the only players we have out injured are the long-term ones, which of course are Callum Chambers, who's missing for the rest of the season with his cruciate, and Kieran Tierney, whose shoulder injury is going to keep him out until March. Apart from that, it seems to be a relatively fit and healthy squad for Mikel Arteta to choose from, which is in stark contrast to what we've just heard about Crystal Palace, who've got a whole host of players out injured. Will that make it easier for us? I don't quite know. You know, we're still very much in the early stages of the Mikel Arteta reign. It has been very positive, no question. And the fact that he was able to elicit a response from the team when it didn't turn up in the first half against Leeds, it augurs well. But it's about getting that from the start in every game. I know it's not possible, but, you know, when you're trying to drag yourself out of the hole that we've been in over the last little while, you can't afford to throw away a half of football, regardless of how weak, in inverted commas, the opposition might be because of injury. Palace start the game above us in the table, which isn't to say that we're the underdogs or anything, but we are going to have to turn up, do a good job, be professional, put the work in like we did against Chelsea, like we did against Manchester United, like we did in the second half against Leeds. And if we do that, then we give ourselves a chance of winning this game. You can't take anything for granted, but hopefully if we put in the effort, if we put in the hard yards, we can get the kind of performance and the kind of result that will make us all happy at the weekend. Let's hope they can produce that. James and I will be here on Monday with an Arsecast Extra. Hopefully it will be a goodly morning. You can subscribe to this show on iTunes, in Spotify, on Acast, in all your favorite podcasting apps. Thank you, as always, for being here. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your continued support, for everything that we do. We really, really appreciate it. We'll be here on Monday to hopefully talk about a good Arsenal win. In the meantime, have yourselves a great weekend. Until the next one, cheers. Bye-bye. Good afternoon. A statement for those who wish to watch the FA Cup games this weekend. Many people have said they feel the process is complicated. However, this could not be further from the truth. It's remarkably easy. First, drink 4 pints of Budweiser. After you finish your 4th pint, you will be given a voucher. With the voucher, you may purchase an Emirates airline flight to anywhere in the world. Return, of course. On your arrival back in the United Kingdom, you will be given a bet slip. On that bet, you must place a treble each-way Trixie Yankee Super Heinz Goliath Accumulator. If your bet comes in, you will then be permitted to watch the game in a tiny box in the corner of a website. This is the future, bitches. Get on it.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.